Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Genevieve Kim, and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, guys.
All right.
Today's quote that we're going to cover is a long one, and boy, is it a quote. Okay. This is by Abraham Aboulafia from Sefer Ha'ot, the Book of the Sign. More bitter than death is his filth, and therein is sunk his strength. And sweeter than honey is his blood, and therein resides his spirit, in the dwelling of his heart. The soul of every living, enlightened person travels from the tent of filth to the tent of the blood, and from the dwelling of the blood travels to the dwelling of the heart of heaven. And there you shall dwell all the days of your life. Break it down, Zohar.
More bitter than death is his filth, and therein is sunk his strength. Death is the thing that we fear the most. It's the thing that we imagine to be the most painful. According to Aboulafia, there is something even worse than death, and that is filth, however you want to understand that term. Perhaps filth refers to that which disgusts us. We all have the fear of being finite, of not mattering, of being small, but that's a kind of existential pain. There's also just this bodily, like, disgustingness that the goriness and grossness of certain phenomenon. And I think if you have a certain alienated relationship to yourself, or you take a certain camera angle on yourself, you might find yourself disgusting, especially when you think of yourself purely in, like, bodily, physicalist terms. And actually, it's connected to death because death exposes this physical dimension of us. Certainly, when we define what a death is, one is the body just at some point stops moving. So what is this body thing? And then at the same time, though, is sunk our strength. The very thing which makes us disgusting also makes us strong. It's an ambivalent phenomenon. We cannot actually be mighty in the biological sense of having motility, having the ability to move around, but also in the spiritual sense of having agency and setting ourselves purpose, unless we have this bodily substrate that is a source of weirdness. If you've read the Goosebumps books as a kid, I think you can probably relate to that. And he probably had a lot of technical terminology with this stuff, meaning these words signify at multiple levels. But blood should be also maybe something that, for the queasy amongst us, I consider myself queasy. I didn't like to get shots as a kid. I used to hide under the doctor's table. So by the way, Judaism, going back to the Bible, forbids eating animal or human blood. But the reason for that isn't because blood is bad tasting. And it may not even be because cannibalism is immoral, although it is, but because blood is understood to be the place where vitality and personality actually live in some way. And again, this is all pre-scientific methods. Perhaps the modern science lab disputes this, but this is a sort of mystical statement and perhaps a kind of alchemical or even quasi-scientific statement. And when we recognize that blood is a source of vitality and of spirit, then it becomes sweet to us, even though if we were just looking at it in physical terms,
ew, gross.
And that leads then to the final conclusion, which is that actually the journey of the human being to the most enlightened state, to the most spiritually realized state, requires passing through filth and through blood. And I think you can understand that on multiple levels, but maybe the best way to summarize everything I've said is this phrase that comes from the Talmud, which is, the Torah was not given to angels of heaven. It was given to people of flesh and blood. And so the Torah is, let's say, a wise document. Why wasn't it given to angels? And one answer might be because angels don't have free will. Angels don't have agency. Angels don't have personality. They're stuck in this ethereal realm. But human beings are complex and they're interesting. and they're disgusting and they're filthy and they're cruel, but that's who we want to give the Torah to because that makes for a better story.
This quote is alchemical in format, isn't it?
This
terminology.
Was kind of a nod to your request that you were interested in alchemy. So it was the first.
Yeah.
You know, it was a small sort of canopy, but I was like, also like the image that is in the meditation is from an alchemical manuscript. The main idea is that the journey begins with filth, which in the alchemical opus is called the nigredo. To which extent that Abulafia, Zohar can do a better introduction to who Abraham Abulafia is than I can, but we're talking like 13th century Jewish mystic who, correct me if I'm wrong, Zohar, because I don't want to make any mistakes here, who had a more heterodox use and understanding of the Zohar, less orthodox, I would say, less rigid. And the Sefer Ha'od is a text where you find these sort of passages, but also it's full of techniques I'd never done any of this. I'm no one to talk about it. But one thing how I came to this quote why I was interested in this quote, because there's a guy in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who's called, me and Zohar had talked about him in the past. His name is Moshe Idel, or Idel Moshe. I always get like the order.
Moshe Idel.
Moshe Idel. Okay. Who is one of the foremost academic experts on the study of Kabbalah. And he's the intellectual descendant of a guy called Gershom Scholem, who was, I would say, he unified the whole study of Kabbalah in early 20th century. Gershom Scholem was also a very big influence in our philosophers, which are not specifically invested in Judaism, but nonetheless. Going back to Idel, the idea is that he was one of the first, a lot of his work is focused on analyzing Abulafia, and there's a text by him on Abulafia. And so why alchemy, Kabbalah, like these are very big terms, no? And the syncretism has no end, or when does one start, when does the other finish? But yeah, my initial intention was like, after reading this book I saw this quote, and I think it represents fairly well the idea that if you want, to put it like in a bombastic way, if you want gold, you need to we're going to keep this PG-13, you need to grab the feces of your life. The gold is in the feces. It's in the field. It's in the dirt. It's in the mud. You have to, yeah.
And I know little of alchemy, especially compared to you, but that's usually the thing that always comes to mind first. I feel like turning sulfur to gold, you know, turning garbage into.
There's a teaching in Jewish mysticism from a later thinker, Schneer Zalman of Leadi, that goes like this: the lowest is the highest. And there's a technical interpretation to this. The lowest is the highest. But of course, it's such a poetic thing. You can really it can stand on its own. The technical interpretation is that in Kabbalah, there are 10 sefirot, 10 attributes of God, 10 sort of personality types or archetypes within the Godhead, and that you can find in reality. And the highest of these is Keter, which is the crown. You also have that in yoga, the Indian tradition, right? Like the chakras. The crown is physically the highest, but it's also the most exalted. It's the most respected. It's literally the symbol of the kingship. And then you have, yeah, amazing. And then at the bottom, you have Malchut.
Jen is showing us a picture.
Jen is getting ready.
So Malchut means a lot of different things: sovereignty, kingdom. But broadly, Malchut corresponds to the human plane. It's the lowest. It's the lowest sefirah. It's the most incarnate. And in some versions of Kabbalah, Malchut means the people of Israel. So, what does it mean to say the lowest is the highest? Well, Keter, which is the highest, is the most inaccessible. It's the most abstract. and therefore something that we cannot perceive directly. Malchut is what we know. It's the most obvious. It's the most familiar. To say the lowest is the highest, you can take that is very literally and say Keter is Malchut, which is the most radical statement. Or you can take that is transitively, transactionally, and think of it as a movement, that the way to actually reach and understand Keter is to understand and relate to Malchut. So you don't need to escape where you are in order to go find God in heaven. You don't need to leave your everyday life in order to go and engage in theology. Rather, whatever you are doing, whatever you are feeling, wherever you are, no matter how uncomfortable or no matter how seemingly mundane or anti-spiritual it is, that is the teaching. And that is where Keter is revealed. Keter is not revealed when you try to put on your philosopher's hat and go think about nothing but God. It is revealed through that which seems to be most at odds with the high heavens. So I know Genevieve, she's got her Kabbalah book out, and she's also got a background in yes, tarot and astrology. So I'm curious where she's going to take this.
I'm going to take it from the Hermetic tradition.
All right.
Okay. And the Hermetic tradition is as above. Say it with me.
So below.
So yes. Below. Yeah, but then it's so below as above, right? So that's the yes.
Yeah. And then we'll draw on to this idea of, okay, no mud, no lotus. So this is interesting. And so what I saw as I was thinking, and I haven't read Sefer Howell, but I'm just like, the imagery that came up for me is mud and then, right, blood, which is actually, there's this quote of, it's actually interesting how this quote of blood is thicker than water. We've all heard that. But actually, the true phrase actually is the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb. Right. So actually it's who knows? They might have been two separate, like they came from different centuries. But the idea of this is that when I thought of blood, I immediately came to covenant. And which is interesting, Zohar, because now you're telling the covenant, right? And you're talking about the covenant. And I think immediately like the promise of the Israelites. So in any case, from this, I thought, okay, but that's that covenant to heaven, right? Heart and heaven.
By the way, Genevieve, on that point about the blood of the covenant, Ezekiel 16:6 goes like this. Then I passed by and saw you kicking about in your blood. And as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. That is Ezekiel's interpretation of the Exodus story, that essentially God took the people out of slavery and brought them to a liberated state. But it also corresponds to a baby that's just been born, that's totally vulnerable. Like covered in blood, right? And then it's a decision to let the baby live even after they've been born. Because if you live in a time of exposure, they're still dependent. So the blood of the covenant is, it corresponds to this idea of I'm going to choose to take care of you, but it's super gory, right? Like you're born in blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how we come into this world as well. We come into the world like that. We come into the world. It's interesting because life begins in filth, right? We were already talking about that. We're blood when we come. And it is that yes. And I that's so beautiful, Zohar, when you talk about yes to, like, he's basically saying live, right? And our existence here, it's what gets us to that next Sephiroth, right? Or pass through the next layer of the tree of life. So for me, I didn't know that Sephiroth was from this mysticism tradition. I actually didn't know what was coming today, you guys. I didn't do my homework. But I immediately thought, oh, this sounds a little tree of life-ish. And it's really beautiful that the imagery that he's been able to do. And it makes me think of creative logos, which is really word and how beautiful and powerful he's done. And so, guys, you have now a sheep who's going to read this book. You now have a believer.
I think it points also, I think human beings are animals. And I don't mean that like normatively, although also normatively, like we are psychologically like animals in many ways. And we're obviously physiologically, we are literally animals. But even without mysticism, a huge part of what Judaism is about, and I'm sure many other religious traditions as well, is in some sense to transcend our animal nature. And there's different techniques and strategies for doing that. And some people take the view that our animal is entirely bad and needs to be denied or put in the basement.
Or whatever.
And that's the ascetic tradition or the saintly tradition of the body is evil and the soul is good. Judaism takes, and hedonism, of course, maybe denies that there's anything to be ashamed of. And the more, like, the more pleasurable your physical life, the better. And that's all there is to it. Judaism takes a little bit of a middle way where the physical can be sanctified, but is in need of sanctification. And so when you take your animal nature, but you direct it purposefully to a human purpose, then it's no longer merely animal. So you go to the bathroom, like going to the bathroom is not intrinsically holy. It's just a basic need. It's bad if you don't. Obviously, you need to see a doctor. But we make a blessing after going to the bathroom as a way of recognizing that this too is part of what it means to be human. And it's interesting, Milan Kundera, in the beginning of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, talks about the incarnation in Christianity as teaching us the sanctity of the body, that essentially Jesus needs a body not just to suffer, which I think is more the Catholic interpretation, and then lift us out of his suffering, but actually to teach us that God wants a body on some level. And if God wants a body, then God's going to have all the things that happen to bodies happen to God, including going to the bathroom, which is obviously not in the Gospels. But that's offering for us is to think about the logical teaching is that God goes to the bathroom. So yeah, exactly, Cyrus. Holy shite. And then that means that not every animal urge that we have is holy, but it has the potential to become holy either by directing it to a purpose or by not letting it rule us. So whereas an animal operates purely by instinct, and this is why free will is so important in religious tradition, free will is the not just the abstract choice to do good rather than evil, or not just the choice to exert your personality in general. It's specifically the ability to not be an animal. Your animal nature represents your lack of free will, and your human nature represents your ability to transcend your animality. So something to think about. I know every religious tradition has things that it celebrates and cultivates as virtues and values. I think one reason why Rabbinic Judaism, which is the tradition that Abu Afia comes from, emphasizes learning and contemplation is because these are activities not only unique to humans as compared to animals, but they're cultivating activities that hopefully allow a person to be better at saying no to instinct.
But do you think it is first necessary to acknowledge your baser parts before you can master them? Or you just ignore them?
No, I think for sure acknowledge. There's a fun teaching by this guy. He was super old. I'm forgetting which rabbi it was, but he would wake up. He was very old, so old he was frail. And his students were concerned for his health and were trying to tell him, don't wake up so early in the morning and learn. It's okay. Like, you're old. Just get up at 10 or 11. The guy was getting up at 5 in the morning. And he said, I can't. I have to get up early because my Yetzer Hara, my evil inclination, is getting up early to do battle with me. And if I don't get up early to do battle with it, then it's going to win. So yeah, absolutely acknowledge that we have an evil inclination or a demonic urge or just that animal instinct or whatever it is. And then the more you acknowledge it, the more you can recognize that it's a constant battle.
Yeah, because we're emergent from our animal aspect.
I could interject something out of the mud.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I could interject something here that would totally shatter this kind of quasi-Darwinian evolution from animal, because if you look at something that I've spent my fair amount of time studying, like the ancient Vedic religion. So what we have, like what people call Hinduism today, right? But that's an umbrella term. There are so many things in there and not necessarily tied to the ancient Vedas or but there's this idea in the Veda, like in a text that I spent a lot of time looking at, called the Shatapatha Brahmana, which is basically a theory of why they do the ritual or why they do the sacrifice. No, it's like the Veda, you have ancient Vedas, the sacred texts of the Indian subcontinent. There's divisions internally, and What I'm trying to say is that there is this idea, which is insane, that originally all beings were biped. No?
Bipedal?
Bipedal, yeah, standing on two legs, which is like what defines, quote unquote, a human being. No? What animal do we have which is bipedal? Maybe some birds.
Kangaroo?
Yeah, but you get the idea, no? There's this idea that animality is tied to being on four legs. So on the ground, there is no, it's not vertical, it's horizontal. So it's on the ground. And also there's, this is what I wanted to bring up, and I was trying to think about it. How do I keep it PG? We have a cranium, no? We have a skull. And that skull, the brain, concentrates a bunch of nerve endings. There's another area in the body that concentrates a bunch of nerve endings as well, which for quadrupeds, fulfills and functions an epistemological, let's say, a knowledge, a cognitive function. You know what that area of the body I'm talking about?
It's the gut, no?
No.
Oh, I know what it is. The other end.
The anus, right? Yeah. And there's a reason why that bony structure there is called the sacrum. They used to take that stuff out of the animal and put it in the sacrificial altar. It's, at the end of the day, it's a huge mystery. But what the Indians said, or like the ancient Vedic said, is that from a biped species, a lot of members of the genus became quadruped. No? And the beautiful, and when you ask why, it's because a lot of them became afraid and bowed down. We still stand. And this is because you would have to go into, let's say, the theology of ritual and all this, but the main idea is that when in the Indian tradition, and this is like my forthcoming manifesto for lightning, is connected to this. In the ancient Vedic ritual, the sacrificial post is called the yupa. A yupa is just the sacrificial post, represents this movement of a being bowing down because the only animals are sacrificed in the yupa. So it's this idea that when they face the yupa, there's an awe, there's a fear they feel. So which, let's say, represents an animal being in four legs in front of a stick, in front of a wooden pole. No? Yupa, and this is why my nod to what we're doing is to this, yupa in Sanskrit means thunderbolts or lightning. So it's the experience of something which is awe-striking. It asks for reverence. It induces the shift from, let's say, a transcendental sphere to an immanent sphere. Personally, myself, I'm more interested in immanence than transcendence, because I believe that, this is going on a tangent, no? I believe that necessity today is more important than freedom. That we shout for necessity. We don't shout for freedom. We want meaning. We want sense. We want good authority. We want, let's say, some sort of structure that makes sense of why we're here. Why do we do what we do? What's the point of all of this? That's not freedom. That's necessity, what you're asking for there. So it's not we need to transcend our animal nature. What we actually want is to become more animal, in a sense. We want to become more human. We want to be more communal, part of something that is beyond, bigger than us. We don't know where we have our will. It's more guided, in a sense. Yeah. Yeah, that's my anti-Darwinian stance on like why we don't need to transcend our animal nature. Yeah.
I couldn't help but think of, there's so obviously in the Greek tradition and in Plato, we have this idea of the original human being as a hermaphrodite, and then the gods create a line, or what they
Aristophanes, say, yeah,
they cut it in half, and then and then face man and woman towards one another, and so that's comes the idea of the sort of the two missing pieces that find one another again in love. In the Symposium. And you have the same teaching also in Jewish rabbinic literature. What's interesting about that is that if you agree with this thesis that the first human being was actually two human beings that were connected, they were facing out. They weren't facing one another. They were back to back. And the reason for their severance from one another was so that they could face one another. So they were it was a two-faced being, but one in which those two faces couldn't actually look at one another. See what I'm saying? And so by having the original androgynous, God invents the back. The face didn't, the human being was two-faced, but zero back.
Right, interesting.
And then in creating the back, creates the encounter. So that goes to your point about the anus and the sacrum as the second head, is that that actually had to be created in order for there to be relationship, which you didn't have before. You had perception before, but you didn't have intersubjectivity before. Okay, tell me, what are you holding on?
This is Aleister Crowley's, in the Hermetic tradition, everybody has to do, when you become an apprentice, you have to draw your own deck. And this is Aleister Crowley, and he designed it with an artist who's slipping my name, but she was really important, Frida something. And basically, this is the card it's the 14th in the major arcana. So if you think of the major arcana being the wheel of life, we're going through the
Sephiroth
of life. Yep.
Yeah.
Is that this one is essentially, this is actually, it's like, it is alchemy, but it's actually the art card. And the art card, it's fascinating because in other of the tarot cards, it's not called art, actually. The 14th key in tarot, I'm just looking it up, is typically, it's temperance, which is very interesting, right? Because it's temperance, and we're literally talking about like this idea of, can we actually temper or think about like, how do we manage our animalistic or not, right, desires? And this is actually just basically saying, Crowley, who is very much from the Hermetic tradition, is, no, actually look at it from this perspective, that it's actually, it's the alchemy. Alchemy is the temperance, right? Because you see that the mixing of the two faces, and then you have actually the red and the white, which is interesting. This is blood and water, right? Essentially, that's coming together. So take what you will from it. So I just think it's so fascinating how we're coming full circle. And by the way, I haven't studied my Hebrew yet, but what is this Zohar?
It's difficult to see from the screen because it could be one of two letters, but it's showing up backwards to me. It's either a Samech or a Mem Sofit. What is the significance of the letters in the deck? And then I could tell you what it is.
That letter, it coincides actually with, very specifically, actually I'm looking it up right now. It corresponds to the spelling of Smuk.
Samech. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the S sound in English.
Yes. And that's just like where, okay. And I'm curious if you can expound on what is this?
The Samech is it's a very important number.
Yep. 120 letter actually, mysticism. Right?
Samech 120? No.
It Samech says 120. The number is 120. That's the number it's associated with. But anyways.
Pretty sure Samech is 60.
Oh, it says 60, but then, no, it says 60. But then, oh, wait, when you put S Samech with the other, it's, yeah, anyways, it adds up to 160. Anyways.
Oh, just, if you have Samech times two. Oh, wait, Samech with, what's the other letter?
This is a Hebrew lesson. I cannot read it fully.
Okay. Let's take a few steps back.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's the Hebrew language is important in mysticism. Why? Let's answer this basic question, and then we can understand why Genevieve has got a tarot deck that's got Hebrew letters on it. So fundamentally, it has to do with the idea that God created the world with language, and that the world is composed of letters that God rearranges. So even though it says, God said, let there be light, which imagines that God spoke the world into being, there are also ideas that actually the words that God spoke already existed, and that creation is just the rearrangement of this sort of fundamental substrate, and that substrate is letters. And so if that's the case, the Hebrew language is holy. Now, every religious tradition thinks its language is the tongue of God, the holy tongue. So we can get into that, but let's just stick with this idea that God speaks Hebrew specifically, and not Sanskrit, not Roman, not English. That means the world is fundamentally created by the Hebrew letters. And there are many, I am not a mathematician, so I don't know if there are infinite permutations, but presumably you can just keep adding letters together. And so there's a lot of varieties you can do. And much like with human DNA and RNA, it's just four letters that get rearranged. So this is actually not far off from where modern science went in terms of understanding that what makes me is ultimately just a bunch of DNA sequences. That's pretty interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Only they have, 22 letters instead of four letters. So then there's this idea that you assign numerical value to the letters. So the first 10 letters get assigned values of 1 to 10, and then the 11th letter gets assigned the value of 20, the 12th letter 30, the 13th letter 40, et cetera, until you get to 100, and then it's 200, 300, and 400. And so with those basic building blocks, every word has a unique numerical, I shouldn't say unique, every word has a numerical value, and you can look for synonyms, so to say, mystical synonyms, that are words that have the same numerical value. And so even if those words are not the same in terms of meaning, they share a relationship by virtue of this. And that whole field is called gematria. Some people believe gematria is real. It's referenced in the movie about pi.
Yes, that was my reference.
I'm not an expert in gematria. And so I personally, I'm skeptical that it's real, meaning that it's ontologically basic. But I think it's a fine tool to use for interpretation. It's a fun tool to use if there are certain constraints and you actually have something interesting to say and you're not just running off on sort of mathematical chaos. But so anyway,
how would that work? You take two words that are like share the same letters and then try to see how they are the same?
There are dictionaries you can buy that are gematria dictionaries where you can look at, let's say, all the words that have the value of 110, for example, and go and do your gematrias with that. But our ancestors were geniuses, so they didn't need such books. They could just see a word and automatically know the numerical value of the word, like the way that I can look at a stop sign and see that it's red. They'd just see the word eights and immediately know that iron is whatever it is and sodic is whatever it is and add that up.
Seeing the world in numbers.
And then obviously it isn't just one-to-one because you can have long words, you can have multiple words. And so you could do gematrias of this sentence equals that sentence. Now, some people use it as a commentary tool on the Bible where you'll, let's say, look at a word in the Bible and say, oh, the gematria of that word is this. And then the gematria of a similar word is the same. I don't have any good examples to offer, but there are some that actually make you think, I wonder if the author of the Bible did know gematria. Most of the time, I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure that's just a subjective interpolation of the commentator who's making a point, and the point is interesting and it's fun, but it's definitely not there. But there are sometimes they're like, what? Maybe this pattern really is in the text. We care about gematria because we care ultimately about this idea that the world is made of language. That's what it comes down to. And that there's a mathematics to language, much as there's a mathematics to music. You know, we tend to think of language more as poetry or more as expression and less quantitatively. But you can think almost of gematria as a kind of like computational linguistics, albeit on LSD. And then the only thing more I want to say on that is that now with large language models, we actually are seeing a return to thinking about language as computation, because the definition of a word is no longer based upon, let's say, the dictionary definition, which is produced by a bunch of experts that say, here's how the word has been used. It's really just giving almost like assigning geometric value, vector value to a word in mathematical space, and then looking at how close or far away it is to other words in mathematical space and plotting those relationships.
Yeah.
You open up a kind of worms for me, and I don't know what to
talk about. Jennifer.
Can we go back to I do want to go a little, come back. So why is 60 so important? Because before we went on the tangent, went back. What's all of this? Like,
is that the...
I'm just trying to remember something that I learned a long time ago. So this is less on 60 and more on the letter Samech. So Samech has a bunch of associations. One is demonic or negative, which is Samael. So Samael is one of the names for the devil or the other side of God. So besame means spices or scents, but it can also mean drugs. There's a famous commentary, which obviously, like much as in Greek with pharmakon, meaning both the remedy and the poison, psalm can mean a drug or it can mean a remedy. And it was related to the word besamim, which means spices. So psalm is the shortened version of psalmeth. There's a famous line in the Bible and the Torah where it says, this is the Torah that God placed before Moses or gave to Moses. And that word psalm, which means lasim, is to put or to place, has psalmeth in it. So the commentary on it says that the Torah, which God gave to Moses, is a psalm, which means it can be a remedy if you follow it, but a poison if you don't follow it. That's the kind of classical interpretation, is that anything that's a psalmist is ambivalent, can be good or bad. The psalmist is negative, it's ambivalent. So there's a passage in the Zohar that plays on these two words, apiryon and afarsimon. And apiryon is potentially related to the word hyperion. And a farsimon is related to persimmon, like the fruit. These words look and sound very similar, apiryon and afarsimon. But the difference is that the word afarsimon has psalm in it and apiryon doesn't. And so it's like the hyperion is the persimmon if you add the psalmic into it. It makes absolutely no sense if you're like a listener. But essentially the apiryon it will take us full circle to this quote. The apiryon is the highest heaven. It's Keter. And the afarsimon is the tangible world. It's the world of the lotus, the world of a human being, which is sweet, like a persimmon, and spicy and interesting, but it has this psalmeth in it. So the psalmeth, which is this demonic thing, is also the spice of life that makes it different than just the hyperion.
That did just go full circle. Genevieve asked in the chat, is this where the Book of Psalms come from? Is that where we get that name?
That word? No. I don't know the origin of the word psalm. Psalter is probably from Latin, but in Hebrew the word for psalms is tehillah or tehillot. Mm. So it's okay. Not at all related. Yeah, I don't know. If you want to do cross linguistics, then you're in postmodernism. So in the classical mysticism, let's say like the Hebrew language is a holy language. So within that language, you can do these word plays, but it's not as common, let's say, to do the word play between one language and another. But then you do find in more postmodern that you'd be like, okay, for example, the word to sample something, like I'm just making this up right now. So I'm like, okay, so I don't know the origin of the word to sample, but it's probably not from the Hebrew like psalm, yeah. Right? But now it's okay. So when a DJ samples, he's taking the psalm and making a new thing from things that exist, and that's what the psalmic is all about or whatever.
Look at that.
It's like, I do not like nowhere, them no here.
Yeah. I think what's fun about this, I'll tell you what I like about it as a poet, is just it gives you another dimension for relating to language, because often we think about language through the lens of what it refers to. Maybe language in terms of its use value. So like we use slang and we don't think about the meaning of it in terms of its dictionary definition, but we use it because it affects something. But we rarely think of, and then there's a musicality aspect to language, like an emotional aspect of certain words have a cadence or a rhythm. They make us feel certain things. But this idea of like the letters having personalities almost creates this beautiful chaos where under the hood of a word or under the hood of a sentence is all this other stuff that's happening. And if you look closely, you can actually find this sort of philosophical or mystical content, even in the most banal things, which again, it's like we talk about the filth and the blood connecting to the enlightenment. And you could do the same thing with the language, where language could be understood as just this very basic thing that we do. Nothing to see here, kids. But then if you pay attention, it's all of a sudden with this gematria kind of angle, it's wow. Where do words come from? Where do letters come from? Then all of a sudden, even a sentence like, hey, can you get me a cup of water, can be thought of as a mystical statement with all kinds of other interpretations. And this is either crazy making or it's delightful, but that's what Kabbalah is. And probably also what tarot does vis-a-vis the shuffling of the deck is this, it's all about combinatorial math, really. Also generative AI. AI is just taking one thing and then doing variations on it. You're just training your AI on a data set. What are you training to do? You're training it to take that data and just rejigger it. And that's, we've talked about this in the Chronicles chat, but that's a way to think about divine creation, is that God essentially just trained himself on the data set that were the Hebrew letters, or if you want to take a more expansive view, like the Torah in heaven, and then the world is just one version of what God absorbed through that. I'd use Midjourney. So you type in a prompt and then it gives you four different versions, and you can even take those versions and say, I want the variations on them. And all of a sudden you're looking at 16 versions. In the Zohar, it says God created the world 10,000 times and destroyed it 10,000 times before settling on this world.
Sorry, God. Yeah. Midjourney, what's that? Like in a month from now, we're going to be like, that's so 2023?
I have a question. Zohar, actually, on this. I have a lot of questions about everything we just explained.
I just want to say one thing to OpenAI, if you're listening, Sam or Greg.
Welcome back.
So I think maybe you shouldn't have called it your latest AGI development, Q-Star. Maybe you want to call it Samak Star in light of our discussion.
That's good.
I think Hebrew letters would be good for branding.
Yesterday I was at a colloquium of someone who was presenting a paper at University of Toronto on what does Jewish messianic logic, basically the work of Hermann Cohen, who was a Jewish philosopher from the early 20th century, what does that have to say about AI? No? How does it deform AI? And what, there was a few points, I'm not going to discuss the whole paper, but what she was saying was that, Anne-Marie Fowler is her name, is that the future is predicted from the now. And the way that, I'm not an AI data trainer, the way that AI works is that out of a fixed set of parameters that it has been trained on, it predicts answers, or it predicts, in a sense, it projects the future, which it then like replicates, no? And the interesting thing, I think the most interesting part of her whole paper was that ChatGPT is being trained mainly in English, right? And English, how many past tenses does English have? Or future tenses? Like different languages have different past and future tenses and present tenses. So this is like some of the problems that.
You just mean tenses in general?
Yeah.
Doing, will do, done.
Yeah. So what my point being done. That at the end of the day, language is not just about speaking. It's about everything, right? You think linguistically. And it could be debate. There's a bunch of debates around here, but the idea being that you conceive of the past and the future, at least dialogically with another person, through language. So the way you think or the way you interact with the world is through a material which is, it's not static, but it's not chosen. And it's also different from other materials. So this is why I always wanted to study ancient dead languages, because thinking in Sanskrit is totally different than thinking in English, or for that matter, Latin or German, or you can't say the same things or express things in English or in whatever other language than you can in other languages. My question to Zohar is the following. So I'm going to do like a small explanation on this. So I think generally everybody today, like as a kind of vox populi status quo point of view on what language is, has a constantive understanding of language, which what I mean by this is that language always represents a state of affairs. So when we say something, no, we're describing the world or whatever it is that we're talking about. And through my research or whatever, I've inclinated myself to think that like actually language it has a constantive function, no? But it has a greater performative function if the conditions are set. And what I mean by performative here, and this, by the way, was the main driver of, let's say, a lot of the theory that goes into identity politics, queer theory, and all of these things. It also influenced other stuff, but the idea of performing gender, like this is something that Judith Butler talks about, like it comes from here. It comes from like the work of a guy called J.L. Austin. Is this J.L.? Has a book called How to Do Things with Words, which I recommend everybody to read. It's a short read. The idea being that when you say something, you're not merely describing something, but you're like bringing it into the fore, no? And like in certain scenarios, that is more clear than in others. For instance, no? When you're driving down the road and you see a stop sign, stop is not describing anything. It's bringing you to stop, no? So like it has a different...
That's called hortative, hortative in grammar,
Yeah. So my question to Zohar in this regard, perhaps connected to the Hebrew language, is to what extent do the ancients or the experts understand the language working in a performative way instead of a constantive way, like bringing reality into existence instead of describing reality?
The Torah begins with God saying, "Let there be light." If that isn't a speech act, I don't know what is. It's the ultimate speech act. You certainly find many examples of speech acts in the Torah. Rabbis elevated the concept of the speech act into a ritual within everyday life. For example, you're supposed to make 100 blessings in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're supposed to create opportunities where you have the pretext for making a blessing. What is a blessing? It is exactly what you described. It is a performance. You're making something happen as a result of the words that you utter. You're taking a situation that was neutral or mundane and you're elevating it and making it sacred through your words. If you eat a piece of bread and you don't make a blessing on it, on some level, you're stealing that bread from God because God gave you the bread, and you didn't thank him. But if you make a blessing on this bread, all of a sudden you've transformed it. Again, going back to our original quote, a very basic animal thing, eating food, which is just fuel for the machine that is the body, into a spiritual act, into a ritual. In the temple, obviously, the priests were charged with doing this on behalf of other people, and it was a spectacle, and you go and gather around them. And now, with the diaspora and rabbinic Judaism, it's a home-based religion where we're all meant to create micro-temples in our everyday life and create the temple even at the dinner table.
So speech checks.
So language does make things happen.
Yeah.
God makes the world with speech, and we emulate God by using good speech. There are a ton of speech laws. Maybe that's the wrong word. Speech act. But Judaism is not for free speech. Of course, you have the license to say whatever you want, but there are consequences if you say certain things. Consequences for the cosmos. For you. I'm not talking about cancel culture. We're not talking about getting put in, theirim, which is like getting kicked out of Judaism, ostracism for saying something heretical. I'm talking about the idea that if you say something negative about a person behind their back, that is like opening up a pillow and scattering the feathers from the pillow all over the world, and they can't be put back into the pillow. That is how our tradition thinks about even slander, which is true. And some people would even go further and say, even talking about people behind their back positively is a negative thing because it creates a reality. And you should only say things to people's faces because otherwise it almost creates these second, like these surrogate selves that are just out there as like icons. Mm. And then that's a kind of false. Even saying something positive. Oh, Nico's so smart. To somebody else. And no, let it be shown that Nico is smart. Like, why do I have to? Make this persona of Nico but obviously we don't, we who use social media don't entirely ascribe to
that. Yeah. Anyway. I would say that like what I'm interested in is, if you take just like Austin's theory on performative, it's not that anything can be a performative. There are certain conditions that have to be established for language to work performatively. For instance, let's say, a priest marrying a couple, like the
official? Officiating. But so obviously, so in Austin, when I say I do you take this I do?
Yeah. As an official.
Then you change your status, you change your legal status, all that is well and good. But in Judaism and in mysticism, it's not that there are certain things which are performative and other things which aren't. It's all performative, but that doesn't mean it isn't also descriptive. Just describing is something that we do to function. But in addition to that, we have to be very careful with our words because we're creating reality whenever we speak.
Yeah.
I know we're out of time, but this all brings to like the concept, and probably I think Zohar, you could probably explain this more, but the tetragrammaton of Yod, He, Vav, He, right? So Yahweh and the sacredness of it. And it was traditionally it's not spoken. And instead you'll use other names, but that in essence, I think comes down to these sounds, which more or less, right, Zohar, is you can translate it today to be, right? The verb, the Hebrew verb to be. And that means literally I am. And so like God in the burning bush in Exodus is like telling Moses, I am who am. Like you're asking, and I am who am, or I am that I am. And so I think there's like this very sacred aspect of whatever we do speak, right? It is a form of this, dare I say, it's bringing that thought into materiality or that ability to bring manifestation about just through our sounds and our creative logos, going back to that.
Can I say something before we finish?
Because you can have the last word.
Take us out.
Can I have the last word?
Yep.
I think the problem with not understanding language having a performative function is that it can easily language can easily fall down the road of totalitarian discourses, because the idea being that if language is purely a constantive of reality, if language is purely a description of reality, then someone knows what that reality is and others don't. There is an official story of what's going on, and either you get it right or you get it wrong. And this is the problem with understanding language purely in this banal, descriptive way of, oh no, we're just like saying what's going on. It's,
yeah, but like, some performances are better than others, and some are more, I would say, not only more appropriate, but perhaps also in some sense more true. But we can carry that on another time. I think I agree with the caveat, but I also think that the relativists take this performativity a little bit too far as well, as if there's no real basis for why we perform the things that we do and not other things.
That conversation truly evolved into something else. We went from the filth to the blood, and then went to the dwelling of the heart of heaven. Guys, thank you for joining. Thank you for your time. Audience members, if you love this stuff, you can join in on the conversation on Chronicles. Link is in the bio. Check us out on socials and on WhatsApp. Have a great day, everybody.